to Life show. As the UK's integrative cancer care charity, Yes to Life has, for over a decade, been helping people with cancer by bringing choice and control into their treatment protocols and by introducing the many benefits of integrative medicine for cancer. The Yes to Life show looks at integrative medicine from all angles, from the patient's perspective, by talking to practitioners and oncologists, scientists and researchers to increase awareness and understanding of what's working and why. One of the many joys of my job is that I get to meet some extraordinary people, innovative thinkers, people of singular determination and courage. This week, I have a very special guest on the show, someone who has used their own extremely challenging diagnosis as a springboard to step into authenticity and the full power of her individuality. And in doing so, she's become an inspiration to thousands who have found their own inner experience voiced with incredible clarity and beauty, often for the first time. This person is Sophie Savage, author of the enormously successful Cancer Whisperer, and already well into the category of extraordinary survivor of stage 4 cancer. I first spoke to Sophie at a time when she was just beginning to write publicly about the challenges of her treatment before starting on the Cancer Whisperer. So it was an honour and a pleasure to visit Sophie and her extremely enthusiastic new puppy, who does get in on the act a little, at her lovely home in Kent. Hi Sophie, really nice to be back interviewing again.
Thank you for having me.
Great, yeah. I think it was my second Yes to Life show that I spoke to you first. That was in May 2015. And to say a lot of water's gone under the bridge since would be an understatement in your case, I think. So at that time, you'd just written your My Beautiful Brain blog, and I read that, and that's why I contacted you. And you were right in the thick of things, so just sort of feeling your way forward, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the interview, and then the next time I spoke to you, I think it was the end of the summer, and you said, oh, by the way, I've written a book. And I was like, what? Because I knew you were really up against it with your treatment and everything. I didn't know how you could have possibly knocked out the book meanwhile, but yeah, I was pretty impressed. I knew the book was going to be great because I'd read your blogs and things. I knew what a writer you were, but the piece I didn't know at the time was really your background in coaching and everything, and how that came to bear in your book. And these two things came together in a very magic way, I think. In no time at all, you had yourself a bestseller and this fan club of whisperers behind you.
Cancer whisperers.
Yeah. So maybe you could just give us some flavour of what kind of effect this had on you, this turnaround, because, you know, moving from where you were when I spoke to you, that just that step in a, I don't know, 6 months it probably took before you were suddenly being interviewed, you know, for your book and everything, a huge turnaround. What kind of effect did that have on you?
It's been incredibly uplifting and humbling and deeply satisfying. I wrote the book in 6 weeks because I knew, well, I didn't know, but I suspected my time was short.
Mm-hmm.
And I signed up to a kind of program that helps you write a book fast. So I did that. And I just self-published it. I put it on Amazon. I thought it would reach a few weird people like me, hopefully make a bit of a difference. And I you know, when I was diagnosed with cancer, I was grief-stricken. And my grief was much greater than my fear. And I was very surprised by that. And, you know, I later learned that grief is held in the lungs and I have lung cancer. And so I went on an amazing journey of discovery about grief. And a lot of my grief was about what I hadn't done and the dreams I hadn't fulfilled, not to mention the possibility of raising my child, not being able to raise my child. So I was grieving the future I wasn't going to have, and I was grieving all the things I hadn't done in the past.
Right.
And it was full on. And one of the things I really grieved was I'd never written a book. I'd wanted to be a writer since I was 10 years old. And I just hadn't done it. I'd got into all this other psychology-based work, which I was very passionate about, and personal growth. And I set writing aside for that. So I decided, if there's one thing I'm going to do before I go, I'm going to write a book. And I popped it on Amazon, The Cancer Whisperer, and It went to bestseller in several categories very quickly. And then it got media attention, and The Observer wrote an article about it. And before I knew it, I had an agent and a publisher, and it's coming out in America today.
Mm.
It's been translated into 8 languages around the world.
Really
nice. It's just been... you can't plan that kind of thing. You just can't. And that, so I take credit for the way I've responded to my cancer, and I take credit for my ability to write and my passion to be of service to people. And in a way, it brought together all my gifts because I know how to help people through fear, and I now know how to help people through grief and denial and all those things. So it brought together all my gifts, and it was one of 2 books that I couldn't find when I was diagnosed. You've produced the other one, by the way, The Cancer Revolution. So I feel very humbled by it, because something greater than me is at work, and I feel like I've been picked up by something greater, and I'm being used for something I couldn't have foreseen or planned.
Mm.
And that's really the privilege of my life. And now I'm an author. That's my job.
Mm.
I've got an advance on my next book, and
amazing.
I'm a very happy camper.
Yeah, extraordinary. So a lot of our listeners to this show will know who you are, and they probably treasure your book, something very special. But nevertheless, I'm sure they don't want to miss another chance to hear you. However, there's going to be some fresh ears listening out there who want to find out about you. Maybe you can just say what The Cancer Whisperer is about, why you wrote it.
The Cancer Whisperer is, I'd say there's 4 or 5 key reasons I wrote it. One is that when I was diagnosed, I nearly died of fear and shock. And getting through that fear and shock was one of the hardest things I've done. And I'm a pro at doing that. And I saw people around me deeply scared and deeply shaken. And I saw people allowing fear to make their choices and decisions for them about treatment, obeying their doctors without question. And there was nothing on offer that I could find to help people through the terror and the emotional ride that cancer puts you on. It's not just a physical disease. You get treated like as a patient with a disease, not a person with dis-ease. And I think it's a mental, emotional, existential, and in my view, spiritual, but that might not be your cup of tea, challenge as much as a physical challenge. And I wanted to write a book that recognized that and help people meet it at all those levels. It's not a book about how to get well, though it has some tips and it has my treatments in, but I still have cancer. Cancer does not have me. That's my mantra.
That's your
line. So that was one of the reasons. The second was that there's a narrative about cancer in our culture that I find very undermining, even damaging, and that's about the whole battle language that we use. So Richard Nixon declared the war on cancer in the 1960s for political capital, and the metaphor stuck. And we talk about the war on cancer, the battle with cancer. Even Stand Up to Cancer, who do amazing things to raise money for cancer, a lot of patients wrote to me that night saying, I can't watch this because it's rebel against cancer, smash cancer, a killer night of fundraising.
Kind of
it was just awful. And I think cancer is it's a healing crisis. So it's time to make peace with your body and not go to war with your body. And people who die of this disease are said to, they've lost their brave battle with cancer. I mean, how many times was that reported about all the celebrities last year?
Mm-hmm.
And it drives me bonkers, because these people have emotional and spiritual and psychological victories that you can't measure the courage and the transformations and the extraordinary things cancer patients do with this disease. And it kind of gets written off as losing the battle.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my biggest purposes is to change that narrative. I want it to stop. I want new metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
And the cancer whispering is about, let's listen to this. Let's get into a new relationship with this illness. Let's relate to it as a teacher, not an enemy. Because cancer is an illness. It's not an enemy. And like all illnesses, it has something to teach us about how we're living. So that was very, very, you can hear, I feel very passionate and quite grumpy about that.
Good.
And I also wanted to help people direct their own treatment in a system that makes that very difficult, really through no fault of its own, actually. I got caught in the crossfire between orthodox and conventional, you know, orthodox and alternative medicine. So my natural practitioners say, chemo will kill you, chemo will kill you. And my oncologists say, don't do all that diet rubbish and quackery, and it's not proven. And you're stuck in the middle, going, what am I supposed to do?
It's a nightmare.
So for all those reasons, I wrote my book and a few more, but that'll do.
Very good. Yes, it's interesting. The you know, you could say at a certain level, the fundamental human problem is being at war with yourself anyway. People are divided.
Mm-hmm.
And this actually really exacerbates it. Actually, you physically see a part of your body as being working against you in that way.
Yeah.
Is you know, psychologically, it's very damaging.
It doesn't work. That doesn't mean we don't need to do everything we can to cure it.
Mm.
But I don't think the war helps us cure.
So, you brought up the word spiritual there about the book, and it's got chapters with titles such as Knowing Your Purpose and Breaking the Shell, which are they're more the kind of the sort of things you'd find in the world of esoteric writings on a book about cancer. I think in a way that's the heart of your book, isn't it? That message. Yeah.
I think the heart of my book is to help people, help cancer patients have a transformational experience instead of a terrifying one, whatever the outcome. So we don't need to wait till we die to free our spirits. And we say rest in peace, or how about we live in peace?
Right.
And I think it's possible. I mean, I've got a terminal diagnosis, but I've never experienced more vibrancy, joy, and peace than I do now. And I want that for other people. And knowing your purpose, for example, that's an empowerment thing. I mean, I had a very, very dear friend I wrote about in the book. He had cancer behind his eye that had gone into his brain. He had ocular cancer. I mean, it was rough. He had his eye removed. And he was in his early 70s, I guess. He was a grandfather. And he said to me, I don't want to do everything I can to stay alive. I've had a great life.
Mm-hmm.
I want to just savor my last moments. I want to drink champagne and eat what I want to eat and hang out with my grandkids. And his purpose was to relish his time.
Mm.
Whereas my purpose is to stay alive and thrive as long as I can.
Some work to do, yeah.
Because I've got a little girl who's six now.
Mm.
So there isn't a right way to go, and there isn't a right path to follow. When you know your purpose, you can make your choices instead of fear making them.
Right, so that comes up quite a lot about knowing your purpose, doesn't it, in your book? And it's, I mean, it's something.
And there are some skills in the book, but how do you know your purpose? I mean, not many people just know their purpose.
No.
How do you know your purpose? So there's a few skills in there to help people.
And you're presenting cancer really as an opportunity to know your purpose, for the prompt.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay, so I think quite a lot of people have got a preconception that books like yours, which are more on the sort of psychological, emotional side rather than the physical, they're all something to do with putting a brave face on things and being positive and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And that's not really your message at all, is it?
No. I don't do positivity. Well, I don't want to swear on your show, so I won't do that. I won't give you my normal metaphor, but positivity is a kind of false, it's a way of denying what's happening a lot of the time. And when I was diagnosed, so many people said to me, be positive, stay positive, all you've got to do is be positive. And actually there was no room for me to be angry and grief-stricken and scared and a human being. I'm a realist. And I think positivity pushes a lot of your real emotions and your distress down, and it doesn't give you permission to be a human being. So positivity is different to joy. It's different to, it's a judgment. It means I like it. Negative means I don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's far too much positivity around, I think, that actually shuts people down rather than opens them up.
Mm. It's interesting, because you come across, of course, to a lot of people as a very positive person, but it's more like a symptom, if you like, or an expression of something rather than something you've done. Would that be right?
I'd say I'm a purposeful person and a grateful person. And I live in hope, for sure.
Mm.
A hopeful person.
Yeah.
But gratitude and joy and hope are real feelings. Positivity just means I like it or I don't like it. It's a judgment. Right. It's a mental concept. And it's bandied around a lot. And I really don't think it gives people room to. I met a woman she's died now, very sadly. She died age 30. And I met her in a cancer clinic, and she was trying to be positive about everything.
Right, right.
And her family were very devoutly Christian and devoted to her, and totally for her, doing lots of different treatments, and they couldn't have loved her more. But she thought, if I'm negative, I'm going to feed my disease. I have to be positive so I don't fuel the cancer, and I mustn't be stressed, and I mustn't make my body acidic. And she had all this stuff going on.
Mm.
And I said to her, do you know it's okay for you to be terrified? I said, you're 28 years old and you have stage 4 cancer. And the relief when I said it, she was so deeply relieved. And it took her on a great kind of journey into all the emotions she'd never let herself feel her whole life.
Right.
That's what I think of positivity.
Yeah, fair enough.
Also, my own teacher, Brad Brown, he used to say, you know, you can be false positive, false negative, or real. Those are your options.
Right, that's very well
put. And very often people who are false positive, they don't go from false positive to real. They have to go from false positive to false negative, and then they can get real.
Hmm.
If you start false negative, you're kind of ahead of the game.
That's interesting.
That's the psychology of it, is that actually false positive is further away from reality than false negative.
Right.
If that wasn't too psychological.
Well, no, I can see that. It has a sort of appeal to it. A false negative is, well, anybody want to be away from there in a certain kind of way.
Yeah.
Real could seem better than that.
Yeah, so you go from this is awful to, okay, I can deal with this. This is awful, or actually this is what's happening to me.
Mm.
You go from, you know, it's all going to be okay,
yeah,
to this is awful, to okay, now I can deal with this.
Mm. Okay, so between the time, you know, when I met you in 2015, you went through a time there where you were completely up against it with your health.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of kept broadly in touch with what was happening, so I know it was pretty challenging stuff. No room for any complacency, but somehow that only seemed to make you more radical, more determined to do even more. So during that time, you set up your Facebook group, you developed website, workshops, you're giving public talks, and you've really become an inspiration for thousands of people who recognise their inner journey written in your book. And so how did you manage all that at once?
Good question. I think I've always been a very creative and productive person. I've always worked hard, and I love to work. And I love to be of service. I've always chosen. I remember making a decision in my 20s that making money would never be my purpose in life, but it could follow my purpose in life. That as long as I was being of service, then I would be happy to make money from that. And making a difference to other people brings me joy. I think I'm using my gifts in a very integrated way. I think I'm fulfilling my life purpose. So all that makes me more alive.
Mm.
I do need to watch my boundaries. I do need to be careful I don't exhaust myself. And I'm prone to saying yes to too much. So that continues to be a challenge for me, especially when I care about something so deeply.
Mm.
But it, you know, my husband says, if you weren't doing this, you'd start dying.
Right.
because it feeds my spirit. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to feed our spirits as well as our bodies. Mm-hmm. And that gives us life in some way. But it's been quite hectic at times, for sure. Especially because it's been a runaway train that I really didn't plan. Mm. And I'm trying to keep up with it some of the time. But my brother said to me at my 50th birthday, he said, "I'm so proud of how you've been living over the last 18 months. He said, "It's like you're living 1,000 lives." Mm. And that's the title of my epilogue, actually, in my book, because yeah, when you're sick, time gets fat somehow, and it's amazing what you can create in a moment when your mortality is staring you in the face. Mm. You don't waste moments, and I nearly died, and I looked right down the barrel of what I had wasted, and I promised myself I wouldn't waste any more moments. Mm. So here I am doing what I can for as long as I can.
Mm. There's an awful lot of people I say have been inspired by what you've written, what your speeches, but there's an enormous amount of need out there. Mm. And you must experience that need, you know, that people are looking for help. And of course, as you said, you've got to watch your boundaries, you've got your own limits. How do you find dealing with that feeling of that immense need out there?
Well, I need to remember, first of all, it's not my responsibility to respond to that. You know, I can't fix people. I'm not a doctor.
No.
I wrote a book because I thought having a book, for a lot of cancer patients, even having it on audio, you can sit in a chair and listen to it, in a chemo chair and listen to it. But I set up my Facebook group. I remember you writing to me and saying, another thing, you're doing another thing. But actually, I was getting a lot of emails. And a lot of messages by Facebook, and I simply couldn't respond to them. There were probably 200 or 300 emails in my inbox that I've never responded to because I just can't keep up with it.
No.
So what I do is I invite people to join my Facebook group, because there I can answer one question to hundreds of people at the same time.
Great, yeah.
So if they write to me, I say, please join my group.
Yeah.
And actually that makes it more manageable, yeah. And it creates a community that all support each other. I posted yesterday and said, I can't respond to your messages this week. I've got a really full week. Please look after each other.
Right.
And they all do.
That's great, isn't it? So moving on, the Cancer Whisperer was bought by a very respectable publisher last year, who republished, created another wave of whisperers out there. And now you're poised to break into the US market at the same time as a paperback version in the UK is just about to come out. In the world that I inhabit, you're becoming a household name, I'd say. But
not quite, darling, not quite.
We're getting that way. How are you feeling about all that?
I feel very honoured and privileged and excited. America's a very tough market to break into. But the book was auctioned in America. So
great, to the publishers.
I had eight publishers wanted it.
Fantastic.
And yet even now it's hard to get a spotlight on it, even after an auction like that. So, you know, the jury's out on how well it will go in America. And obviously it's just come out today. But I love my editor there. I made the choice based on... I chose the editor who really got me and who didn't just see it as a... I remember my agent saying, what are you listening for when you talk to them? And I said, I want the editor that gets I'm not just a good cancer story.
Right.
That I'm a writer and I'm a teacher and I happen to have cancer. And that's what my editor got. So I'm hopeful that it will touch people out there and make a difference to people out there. We'll see.
Well, you know, if it does, of course it will be a lot of people. That's the great news about it. If it does get, you know, above the parapet, the audience is potentially enormous.
Yeah. That would be awesome.
Yeah. Okay, so what about your epilogue? You've actually added to the book. The new version coming out in the UK is going to have this epilogue in it. Yeah. Why have you added to it, and what have you added to it?
Well, because over a year had passed since I wrote it, and so much has happened since then. So, for example, I mean, the main thing I wrote about in the epilogue was after 18 months of being very stable, I got rid of all my tumours except my primary tumour, which was greatly reduced. It's been very small for a long time. I had new brain tumours came back. Mm. So I went through a massive treatment process last year of dealing with many brain tumours.
While you were doing everything else?
While I was doing everything else. Mm. So I wanted to write about that, and I wanted to write about my journey since I wrote the book and what I was still learning, because I'm still learning. I'm still in I'd say I've graduated from kindergarten, the kindergarten of wellness. But I have a lot still to learn about wellness and taking care of my health. So I wanted to really just update, bring it up to date, and especially tell the story of partly of going through multiple brain tumours again. But also of what it's really like to be a stage 4 cancer patient. And I think I didn't speak to that fully in the initial part of the book, and a lot of people wrote to me who were stage 4 saying, the reason I love this book is that you're not a survivor, right. You're not another miracle story, you're not another stage 4 who beat it, you're a stage 4 who's living with it. And that was a breath of fresh air to stage 4 people, because the majority don't have miracles. And they found that very heartening to go, oh, I can live with this. I can thrive with it. I can treat it like a chronic condition instead of a terminal disease. So I wrote a bit in the epilogue about what I call the tribe within the tribe, the cancer tribe within the cancer tribe, and what it's really like for us to be denied the treatments that we're denied, the kind of unspeakable envy we might feel when people go into remission and recover, because you can't say that. Mm-hmm. And we're delighted and overjoyed for anyone who recovers, but there's this part of you that goes, ah, I wish that were me, I wish that were me. And I want to say it's okay to say that, it's okay to feel that.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make you mean-spirited, it makes you, it means you have a longing to live. That's all it means.
That's interesting, isn't it? So, in a certain kind of way, whereas your book, it's obviously it's got very broad appeal. It's got plenty in it for people who don't even have cancer. I can see how, in a way, it is very much a light for people in your position.
Yeah.
Because it is different, isn't it?
It is different.
And I mean, you know, of course, I know lots of people with stage 4 cancer, and even though some of them have maybe lived a very long time. You know, they still wouldn't say they haven't got cancer, and they're still very much living with it, and it's a different life to the one they had before.
It's always with you. It's a constant, relentless presence. And sometimes it fades into the background, but it's just always there. And oncologists tend to, I mean, I have the most wonderful oncologist, don't get me wrong. We're a real team now, and he really respects me, and he consults me. He would never tell me what to do anymore, ever. We work it out together. We go, well, now what do we do? So I'm very fortunate to have that. But there is a kind of, they like to remind you that you're incurable and that remission. He even said to me once, I said, when would you say I'm in remission? When would you give me that? And he said, well, we wouldn't, because you won't be. And I said, well, what if I was completely tumour-free? And he said, well, it would still be in your blood, so you wouldn't be. And I said, come on, cut me something. And he said, all right. If you had zero tumours in your body, I would say you're in remission. But remission really means a temporary stay of execution.
Yeah, it's not well.
It's not recovery. No, no. So, it's like that being stage 4. It's
a shame, because, you know, an awful lot of that is another layer of ideas, rather like the war against cancer. It's just ideas and the way that people express things, you know, and they haven't got a categorizing system that says you're stage four and that means this. But of course, people are defying what it means all the time. So
yeah.
it is just an idea. And for somebody to hold on to it as hard as he is then, saying, well, you know, even if you've got no tumours, you're not...
I know. Well, I've melted him a bit since
good.
Then. But,
good.
And there are breakthroughs coming through. So there are more and more treatments and more and more things coming onto the market. And no one's really in a position to say you're going to die or when you're going to die. There are some cancers that take you out incredibly fast.
Yes.
But mine was one of them just 6-10 years ago.
Right.
Mine was one of them that would take you out really fast.
Mm.
And now I'm living with it. And my neurosurgeon, when I got the brain tumours, I said to John, I was offered IV chemotherapy that might give me 10 months. And of course, I sat there thinking about my little girl, 10 months, and thought, nah. And I went home with John, my husband, and said, we need a brain doctor, not a cancer doctor right now, because I follow my instincts. And we found a neurosurgeon, and he said to me, they don't fully know what we can do. And he said, you know, he said, you are living with a chronic condition and you need to treat it as a chronic condition instead of a killer disease. And it was such a breath of fresh air to have a doctor say that to me.
Not from an oncologist, though.
Yeah, well, that was the neurosurgeon who said that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I think, you know, just as in as much as your, you know, the battle against cancer is a very deeply embedded idea now that is actually destructive in itself. So the idea that cancer equals death is really deeply embedded in our
psyche. Deeply embedded.
And of course it's less and less true than it was. It never was true, but it's getting less and less all the time.
Yeah.
And but it's going to be a tough one to get rid of, because I mean a lot of the terror you experience actually comes from that place, isn't it?
It's mental. I when I was told I was going to die, I started dying.
Mm.
I didn't feel ill at that point.
Right.
I just started dying.
Crazy.
So it's a big problem. And there's two ends to it, I think, because on the one hand, more and more treatments are coming through and more people are living.
Mm.
And at the same time, more and more people are being diagnosed.
They're getting it. Yeah,
so we're looking
that's
at one
problem,
in two
really.
People now.
Yeah.
And that's the war, in inverted commas, that is being lost, because we're not dealing with the underlying causes.
No.
Cancer's a symptom, in my view, in my humble opinion, IMHO.
I agree with that.
It's a symptom of underlying environmental, physical, genetic, emotional, psychological causes. But oncology treats the symptoms. And that's why I think remission is remission, because you get rid of the tumours, but not the underlying causes.
Mm.
Now, some of those causes are genetic and out of your control. But
many
are in your control.
Yeah.
And that's what I wish the cancer world would start facing into and getting very real about.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, a lot of people are facing into getting real about it,
well,
you know, despite what's going on in oncology. And eventually that will have its effect, but I hope it doesn't take too long.
Me too. Me too. Mm. People are suffering.
They are.
And dying, and awful.
Yeah. Whole
and children.
Decimated. Yeah.
You know, children.
Yeah, I know. Yes, it was a huge eye-opener for me. My daughter in hospital, you know, I never thought about children and cancer at all until that point. But, you know, I came across babies who were born with cancer after that, and I was like, whoa, you know, what are we doing, you know? So, yeah.
And we tend to put pictures on the internet of them smiling with their bald heads in their hospital beds and not of the agony that they go through.
Mm.
And this brings a lot of agony.
It does.
So we need to get to the roots.
Mm.
And that's a movement I would like to be a big part of.
So clearly there was a kind of vast unanswered need that your book, at least in part, is starting to fill. That's why it's been taken up in such a big way. Do you have a suspicion that maybe that's there's a little tip of a massive iceberg that's unanswered need in the whole kind of psychological and emotional area of dealing with what's seen as potentially terminal disease?
I think it's the tip of a cultural... I mean, yes, I would say I'm sure it's the tip of an iceberg. And I don't think that's just about cancer.
No.
I think that's about the whole... the way we relate to illness. We separate the body from the mind, heart and spirit mm-hmm. in our medical system. And we even separate the brain from the lungs, from the heart, from the liver. So, you know, my lung doctors don't talk to my brain doctors. Mm-hmm. I have a neurosurgeon and oncologist who don't really get what the other is up
mm-hmm.
to. And that I find bizarre. So, but also the... we're whole integrated systems, and to think that the mind and emotions aren't connected to the body is just cognitive dissonance to me. It doesn't make any sense.
Mm.
Emotion, energy, emotion. So I think it's a huge cultural problem. I'm very glad to have come across Maggie's Cancer Centres, because I didn't come across them when I was diagnosed.
Mm.
And I think, like Yes to Life, they're different to Yes to Life. I love how you support integrated treatment for patients, because that's so missing. Maggie's doesn't do that.
No.
But they provide emotional counselling and
yeah.
therapy. And I'd love to see a lot more of that. You know, and Penny Bron do some of that as well. So there are some places that meet the emotional need that I didn't discover. But I think there needs to be... it needs to be much, much bigger.
Mm.
And I truly think people will heal more if they get that.
Mm. Well, the great thing about Maggie's is whenever they set up, they're actually setting up in hospital grounds.
Yeah.
So they're actually there. It's still a separate thing. You've been to places which do attempt to bring all of these things into one place. You've attended the clinics. Now, how does your experience of those... it contrasts with what we have here?
Okay, so I've been to a clinic which integrates conventional oncology, you know, so cut it, burn it, poison it, oncology, but they use low-dose chemo with alternative treatments like megadose vitamin C, lateral hypothermia, organic diet. You know, they put it all together, and they also work with people's emotions. In my experience, they did the integrated treatment very well,
mm-hmm.
probably second to none. But the emotional part,
no,
really poor.
Mm.
Well intended, but
mm.
really poor. I mean, poor.
Mm.
I would love to get in there and train.
You're the person to say what's needed, really, aren't you?
Well, it is my... I mean, it may be harsh, but I've been doing that for 25 years, and I really do know how to help people transform their emotional state.
It seems so, yeah.
So it's slightly treated like you get a one-hour module while you're
right.
sitting in your
still
chair.
Still secondary.
And people talking at you rather than working with you.
Mm.
So it's very basic.
Right.
I think it's a long way to go.
So it's a nod in the right direction.
Yeah, it's a nod in the right direction.
Yeah. So it's good to hear it from your perspective.
Yeah.
Okay, so now I've got to ask, as we're getting towards the end of the show, have you got anything else in the pipeline for people? And if you have, is there anything you're willing to give away about that?
Sure. I'm about to do a series of talks at Maggie's centres around the country.
Right.
Which are free. Scott, I can't remember. You can go to my website, sophiesavage.com, to find out where they're going to be.
Okay.
So that's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
I'll also be doing a Cancer Whispering Day in London in the summer with a couple of guest speakers, which will be more... I want to be doing more workshops.
So sort of engage the audience.
Yeah, and I'm doing some. You know, I'm speaking at the Bath Literary Festival. I'm doing a big festival in Holland, the Happiness Festival in Holland.
Mm.
In September. So there's several things coming up that will be on my events page of my website. And I'm writing another book.
I'm
being more secretive.
Really?
About.
Okay, nothing for us.
But it isn't about cancer, but it is about how to live your life to the full. And it really draws on my
right.
25 years.
So this really is a book for everyone.
It really is a book for everyone.
Great.
It doesn't even have a chapter on cancer. but cancer will feature, because cancer is my, I call it my spiritual discipline.
Right.
But yes, I look forward to not writing about cancer, to be honest.
I can believe that, yeah.
But that's going to be fun.
Yeah. Okay, so look, I think we're going to wrap it up there. Sincere thanks for recommending Yes to Life and our book in yours. It's really great to have that. And yeah, really nice to get to talk to you again and share your journey with everybody who's listening. And I wish very much for your continued good health and, of course, for your plans for world domination.
Not my plans, I assure you. Thank you so much.
If you haven't already read The Cancer Whisperer, then don't waste any time, get yourself a copy. And that applies if you have cancer, if you've had cancer, if you love someone with cancer, if you work with people with cancer, or even if none of the above. It's a truly unique book. As usual, you can find links to the material mentioned in today's show on the Yes to Life website. Go to yestolife.org.uk. Click Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar and then click UK Health Radio. Also, a reminder that videos of the brilliant speakers at the groundbreaking Yes to Life annual conference, Charging Down the Wrong Path, Is Cancer a Metabolic Epigenetic Disease?, are now available to buy and download from the Cancer Revolution website. Go to thecancerrevolution.co.uk and then choose Shop. Each video is just £7 and the whole set of six is £35. Be sure to connect to Yes to Life and to me, Robin Daly, on social media to keep up with the news and forthcoming events. Next week, the subject of the show will be a current hot topic, the microbiome and its relation to our health and in particular to cancer. I shall be talking to nutritionist Kirsten Chick, who specialises in supporting those with cancer. I hope you can join me again. Goodbye.